what my goal is, probably in the next half an hour, is just to, not knowing, you know, what your backgrounds are, teach you a little bit about fire, about fire prevention, about fire systems, talk a little bit about suggestions and ideas for church. This is kind of nice because we can get specific, you know, if you guys have questions for how things relate. So I'm going to get into a little bit of history, talk a little bit of case studies, and we'll go from there. So if you need to jump in or interrupt, please feel free. So start with a little bit of Dwight here.
Last week I gave a fire safety talk, and nobody paid any attention. It's my own fault for using PowerPoint. PowerPoint is boring. People learn in lots of different ways, but experience is the best teacher.
So, YouTube, you can get the whole clip. I'm not necessarily promoting or not promoting The Office. However, that episode is perfect when it comes to fire safety and illustrating the point of practice and what happens when people don't pay attention. I apologize that this is PowerPoint, but hopefully we'll get some good illustrations. I got a lot of videos worked into the presentation to hopefully let people who are more professional than me explain things better than I could. I already talked to you guys a little bit. You told me where you're from and who you are and why you're here. What are your positions? Are you just church members or positions at the church? Or
I'm an ex-Navy SEAL and I serve as a I serve as a deacon
okay.
at the church and I'm one of the staff pastors.
Great. Good. Well, good to have you. There are our main purpose, a little bit of background. I'll skip over a bit. Before I get into my trade experience, about a year and a half ago, Southern Seminary came to me and asked me to help them put this conference on. And we had a desire specifically for pastors. And our goal was we wanted to teach pastors and get pastors to all the topics that we're talking about here to see the importance of it and see how to implement them into the church. And, you know, as a pastor or a deacon, you may or may not be the person that are actually doing these things, but ultimately it's the eldership of the church and the leaders of the church that are going to guide the church and are going to tell the different people within their congregation to look at these things or approve budgets and things along those lines. So to get to actually get the pastors and the elders here hearing this firsthand and seeing it, if we can get you to believe it, then it makes life a whole lot easier. It's so much harder when we have the security members or the facility staff members that are here and believing it and are on fire and want to do these things, and they go back and the pastors and the elders say, we don't have money, or I don't really think that, you know, this is important or that's important. So I think it's after listening to some of the stories that we heard today from Tommy and the tragedy at Maryville, and I just listened through the Wedgwood speaker and about the shooting there that happened in 1999, and just hearing these things firsthand from people, it just encourages me, and hopefully it's going to encourage you guys here. So,
where are you from?
I'm from Gettysburg, Maryland.
Really? Yeah, Damascus.
My brother lives in Damascus. I'm from Germantown. Actually, I live in Germantown. So, where in Damascus? It's not that big, so, okay.
Yeah.
He's right off of Goo Road, right past Jimmy Cone. Jimmy Cone, so... Anyhow, speaking of Damascus, I started in 99 as a firefighter with Montgomery County Fire and Rescue and as a volunteer. Damascus, Fire Station 13, I was one station down, which was Station 29. We had a ladder truck that ran into Damascus all the time, as well as a rescue squad, so very familiar with that area. I started in high school doing internships with police department. Found out that when I was in high school that until you're 21, you can actually be a cop and carry a gun. The police department's no fun because you can't do anything. And I turned 18 and had some buddies that said, hey, join the fire department. You can actually get on the fire truck and drive the ambulance and play with the lights and sirens and have some fun. So I started doing that. Went from being an EMT to a firefighter, became a paramedic, joined the Maryland State Police. All I wanted to be in life was a flight paramedic with the Maryland State Police. I loved being a paramedic and emergency medicine, and I love law enforcement. And other than being a rescue swimmer with the Coast Guard, I figured the next best thing was to work for the Maryland State Police. So got hired there. Within the academy, my class actually got furloughed, and so I left and took about a year trying to determine what it was that I wanted to do. I actually, there were some budget cuts, and so 2 weeks into, I want to say 2000, 2001-ish, somewhere in that range. Nope. It was the beginning of our academy class. It just started, and it'll be sidetracked, but it's a good story. All that I wanted for years was to work for the Maryland State Police. I went through 2 years of paramedic school. Anything and everything I had pictures of, you know, the helicopters on it and the Dolphin Eurocopter, and I had the T-shirts, and it's all I wanted. You know, it took a year to get hired and all the schooling, and the second day of the academy, and I woke up one morning and I had this just gut feeling in my stomach, like something was wrong. Didn't think that, couldn't figure out what it was. Throughout that whole day, as the day continued, I kept on feeling like the Lord was telling me, "Hey, Brian, you wanted this," and there were several doors that I pushed open to get in the class, and I pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. Finally, the Lord gave it to me, and I got hired, and they gave me a position. And the second day, I felt like He was saying, "Okay, now that I gave it to you, I'm going to take it away from you. I let you get here, but this isn't what I want you to do." And I never had a feeling like that before. I never had an experience like that before. To this day, I mean, I don't think that I've ever had the Lord speak that clearly to me. But over the course of 48 hours, I felt like the Lord was saying He wanted me to resign. And I'm thinking, I just spent 2 years of my life. This is what I wanted to do. I beat out 5,000 applicants for the job. There was like, I think, 50 of us in the class. And I was thinking, there's no way, Lord, that You want me to quit. But that feeling just grew and grew and grew and grew. Well, within that 48-hour period, they told us, "Hey, there's been some budget cuts. We can't guarantee you your job. Next week, you all may get laid off. You may make it to the end of graduation. We're letting you know up front that this is what's going on." So I took that, and I took that feeling and what I felt like the Lord was telling me, and I quit. And with this being recorded, I'll admit that I cried all the way home. Like, what am I doing? This is all I wanted, and I was crying like a baby. Like, how could I have quit? How could I have done this? But I trusted in the Lord. And within that year, I was with a friend, and he happened to work for the Secret Service. And the Secret Service had always been a dream of mine, and I put in an application. I got hired by the United States Secret Service. That's where I'm currently employed. I'm employed with the Secret Service now. I am now in a position where I'm responsible for emergency medicine, firefighting, and law enforcement. It's more than I ever could ask for. You know, it's the state police never could compete to the opportunities that I have and that He's given me, and the exposure to be able to do things like this and things along those lines. So that's a little bit of kind of that background related to the job. They allowed my class to graduate. They laid everybody off the week after graduation. There was a new budget cycle that came up, and they hired several of the people back. But it definitely was a trial for some people. So I think the Lord saved me, and you know, from that, and just kind of some of the heartache with that. But ultimately, He knew what He had. I think He showed me a lot of things about my life through that experience and just through that opportunity, and showed me how just because I want something doesn't mean that, you know, He wants it for me. And I can't always see the future, but He really had something better in store for me. So anyhow, that's me. As you can see, firefighter, EMT, I'm a hazardous materials technician, former uniformed police officer, certified martial arts instructor. My current title is a physical security specialist. I have advanced training in explosives, and I'm a weapons of mass destruction specialist. Team I work on, I specialize in WMDs, primarily chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear hazards. So with that being said, I'm going to come back to this one in a second. Little disclaimer, I told you about kind of who I am, who my background is, who my current employer is. I'm not here representing the federal government at all. I'm here representing myself. So none of this information in this presentation represents the opinion in the United States government. Although there's multiple qualifications from my employer, this presentation is independent of all their interests. Had to state that from a legal perspective. There's certain things that need to be said. What I am here representing is this, securityatchurch.com. About a year ago, I'm going to talk about this more to the general group tomorrow. I put together this blog for specific people like you. I wanted to put a blog together for pastors to see what was occurring in churches across the country. I try to post as often, as close to every day as possible on different events that have occurred throughout the country, whether it be a church shooting, a theft, a scandal, a fire, a tragic accident, you know, involving a church vehicle, whatever the topic is, I try to post on it and allow this blog to be a resource to pastors to say, okay, these are the things that are going on. This is what's actually happening. These are things that we need to be thinking about in our church. If this just happened here, well, what if that happened that at our church? What are we going to do? Integrated into this is suggestions that I have. You know, there might be a story of something that just happened. This was from Sunday, talking about how due to all the heat and the we've experienced some of the hottest summers, you know, in the last decade. Well, thieves are going to churches and they're stealing all their air conditioning units because they can pull them out of the windows and sell them aftermarket. So, you know, I have a story, I have a link, I have my thoughts, and it's something that, you know what, until I saw that in the paper, I never thought that thieves would be coming and stealing, you know, the window units because they can get some quick money off of it. So that's my blog. Just wanted to mention it for a quick second. Other resources on there. And yep.
We had copper downspouts.
Stolen. That I've seen a huge trend in that. When was that?
That was probably 3 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. We replaced them with cheap ones. Now they don't have any recycling.
I've seen that a lot. Actually, I've seen that a lot in the last couple of years in the news.
Yeah, older buildings. There was an old Catholic church building that was abandoned, and they would, I mean, as far up the building as they could get, guttering and down.
Just taking everything.
Man,
it's true. It happens, and you guys experienced it. But I tell you what, I talked to another church about that, and they wouldn't believe me. You know, they wouldn't believe that somebody would actually come to their church and do it. But it happens. All right, let's get into fires. 1980, November 21. This was one of the, not the deadliest, but one of the most, I think, top five deadliest fires that actually occurred in a hotel. It was at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. I don't know if any of you guys have been to Las Vegas, but the MGM Grand that caught on fire is now actually Bailey's, and they've built a new MGM Grand hotel. But the fire started, it was an electrical short, and it happened in a deli on one of the lower levels. 679 people were injured. There was 85 fatalities. 80 of them were killed on the top three floors. Where no fire was present. In your opinion, your guess, you're not firefighters, but what are your thoughts? Why did so many people die on the top of the hotel compared to the bottom? Smoke inhalation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I figured that, but where does that come from? The ducting? Or?
Yep.
Comes up the stairs, I guess.
I'll go back to the picture here. Basically, you see this in newer hotels, but definitely in older buildings and high rises, similar to what happened on 9/11. You have stairwells, you have elevator ducts, and as that smoke starts pooling, it shoots right up the elevator ducts, right up the stairwells. Smoke rises, heat rises, and that's going to bring it straight up to the top. It's going to hit the ceiling. As soon as it hits the ceiling, it's going to start packing down. I have some videos to show you some illustrations of fires, and we can actually see how that occurs and what happens specifically. But you nailed it. It was related to the smoke inhalation. So this disaster and the study of it really led to a general publicizing of the fact that the building fire and the smoke inhalation is more serious than the flames. You know, everybody thinks that we got to get away from the flames, and the flames are dangerous, but it's that smoke and those toxic fumes and that lack of oxygen that's really what's killing people. A lot of people that die in fires and even smaller house fires die due to those fumes and suffocation before the flames ever hit them. So what happened? Well, 90 days later, there was another fire. February 10th, 1981, the Hilton Hotel in Las Vegas caught on fire as well. This time it was arson related. Somebody was trying to mimic what occurred 90 days prior. Well, over those 90 days, we learned a few things. As you can see here, only 250 people were hurt in 8 fatalities. 8 compared to 85 is a drastic difference. I won't get into all the details of the things that were learned. Some of them specifically had to do with having people stay in their rooms rather than the flooding into the hallways. There was more ventilation in their rooms. They were able to just contain the fire differently. A lot of it was related to their incident command and the individual things that the firefighters did. That part's not necessarily important, but what's important is that over the 90-day period, things were learned, and the things that were learned saved lives. Why are we studying this now? Because the things that happened before and the people that died before, this whole conference, you know, the things that we heard from Tommy at the main session, we can learn from the mistakes of others, we can learn from tragedies, so we can prevent it from happening at our churches. This here is going to be a video. It's the Station Nightclub Fire. I don't know if you guys recall this or familiar with it, but it happened in Connecticut in 2003. The fire started from a pyrotechnics display the band manager had set up on the stage. It's a small nightclub. 230 people died or were injured. 100 people died. While you're watching this, think about this fire illustrates the principle behind people go to the same exit that they enter from. When tragedy happens and people freeze and people get scared, they know one thing. They know how to get out the way they went in. So watch this video. I'll get back to that point in 1 second. 230 people injured, 100 people died. I misspoke. This is actually in Rhode Island, not Connecticut. Couple things with this video. Is that your first time seeing that?
I think so. So I guess like once a few people collapse in the stairwells, then you got.
So here's a layout of the nightclub. There's a stage. Pyrotechnics were lit in these two spots. Dance floor. This is where the video was showing that main. Sorry, my pointer is not very good here. This main entry point. So people came in. The only way out they knew was right there. Well, it had that stairwell. So as people were coming out, collapsing and getting trampled and getting stepped on, just a body count started building up right here, and people couldn't get out. There's an exit door here. There's an exit over by the main bar. And there's an exit by the kitchen. And I don't know if you guys remember. Towards the end of the video, it got quiet for a second, and the video panned towards the back, and you could see the flames. Well, they were actually showing this back door here. The door was shut. Nobody was coming out. Nobody was coming out that exit. So this fire in this video shows us multiple things. I mean, you guys nailed on it how quickly it went from, you know, flames to the whole entire building being fully engulfed in flames and incinerated. But from a teaching point, it also illustrates the point of, emergency exits and how are we going to get people out. And when you think of your church, I don't know the exact layout or blueprint of your church, but I would assume that there's a main entrance that the majority of people go through. You said it was 100 years old. I'm sure there's still additional exits. You know, they probably, when it was built, it didn't have all the fire codes, obviously, that we have now. But as pastors, as administrators, what are you going to do in the event of a fire? How are you going to get your congregation out of that building safely? How are you going to get them, to disperse in an even manner and get out to the closest exit? So those are things individually that you need to think of at your specific church. I'll get into some ideas and some suggestions later on in this, but I highly recommend you just contacting somebody from the Louisville Fire Department and saying, hey, here's our facility. We want you to come in, and we want you to tell us what your suggestions are, things that we should change. Give us your input on an evacuation plan. That's one benefit. Another thing is you saw that smoke. I have some other videos that illustrate it a little differently, but do you want the fire department's first time that they're coming into your building when it's pitch black and they have to feel their way around? Or do you want them to have come into your facility and to at least have an idea and know, okay, when I go into the congregation, there's some aisles and some pews, or there's stairs or there's exits, and actually have the ability to do a little bit of a pre-plan of your facility, heaven forbid, before they had to go into it in an actual emergency. So just something to think about, to consider for your specific facility there.
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
Do you happen to know, I know a firefighter would wear an air tank that provides an air.
Yes, sir.
But are there portable masks? Like, you know, when you wear a filter when we're working in construction or something.
Yep.
Do those filters smoke, or do they make those?
When I'm done with this, and ask me that again, and I'll address that. All right, so just remember that, because I do have some suggestions that I'll give you. Fire dynamics. What is a fire? How does a fire occur? There's three main things that we need for a fire. We need oxygen, we need heat, and we need fuel. Well, if you have a glass of oxygen, a glass of heat, and a glass of fuel, you're not going to get a fire until you mix it all together and there's a little bit of a reaction. Once that reaction mixes those three entities, we have a fire. It's an exothermic chemical reaction, and it requires all four sources to occur. So a little bit of an idea on how a fire starts. Once a fire starts, different products of combustion, you have heat, you have smoke, you have toxic gases, and you have decreased oxygen. Those gases and that smoke is going to pull that oxygen out of the air. The oxygen is going to be used to fuel the fire, and you're not going to have it to breathe. Carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is associated with fires, but you don't have to have a fire to have carbon monoxide. It's known as a silent killer. We'll watch a quick video.
Is colorless, odorless, tasteless. It's invisible to all the human senses, but it has the power to seriously injure and even kill. Once exposed to carbon monoxide, it seeps into your lungs with every breath you take, making its deadly way into the air sacs of your lungs, where it binds with hemoglobin, the red blood cells that carry oxygen through your body. The problem is carbon monoxide latches on to hemoglobin more quickly than oxygen, and it starts taking over. On the most basic of levels, your cells are literally suffocating. Within minutes, a person can feel flu symptoms, such as headaches, sore eyes, and a runny nose. Once it attaches to 10 to 15% of the blood's hemoglobin, you feel dizzy, confused, and achy. At 30 to 40%, a person becomes drowsy, lethargic, and slips into a coma. At 60 to 70%, it's fatal. According to the CDC, about 500 people die each year from accidental carbon monoxide poisoning. Nearly 2,000 people commit suicide using the gas, often by inhaling car fumes. Recovery can be as simple as getting away from carbon monoxide sources, or as complicated as using a hyperbaric chamber to force pressurized oxygen into the body to fight poisoning. It's hard to predict how much each person will be affected by carbon monoxide. It all depends on how much is in the air, how long, and how hard someone breathes it in.
All right, so as the video said, it's a colorless and odorless gas. It inhibits oxygen from joining your red blood cells. It could be as serious as needing a hyperbaric chamber to treat it to death. And symptoms are similar to flu, headache, nausea, dizziness, and you get a cherry red skin. Why am I bringing up carbon monoxide? Main reason? People don't think about it. They don't think about it in their homes. They don't think about it in their churches. We'll show you another video here involving a church who suffered some issues related to carbon monoxide. But on my blog, I've tracked, a dozen or so cases in the last year of churches that have had to send people to the hospital due to carbon monoxide poisoning. Do you know what type of furnace you have at your church? Is it a boiler? Okay. Do you have carbon monoxide detectors at all? Okay. Have you seen a carbon monoxide detector?
It looks like it's just a fire detector.
I have one in my house.
Yeah. Looks like a smoke detector. Buy them for a couple bucks, and it can save your life. People who experience, as a firefighter, carbon monoxide calls that we go on, people never know it's there. You're not going to know it's there, until it's too late, until it's, encompassed your body and negative harm is starting to occur. So, we'll show another video here. Here are some things. Gas appliances, ranges, ovens, clothes dryers, heating, portable heaters. If electricity goes out, portable generators, gas power generators, all those things, that combustion and the off gas is going to create carbon monoxide and things to be concerned about. Never operate fuel burning appliances in any room without adequate ventilation, especially if people are sleeping there. Gasoline power tools, inside, if you're doing construction or people doing renovation, keep that in mind. I don't know about anybody ever burning charcoal, but it's been a concern. Obviously, if you're grilling, let's do it outside rather than inside. I think that would be common sense, but it's happened. And burning camps or burning fuels, the Coleman things. So keep that in mind, sir. Carbon monoxide, I believe, is lighter than air, so it's going to sit low, and I will double check that exact answer, but I'm 99.9% sure that it's lighter than air.
Can
Jamestown Hospital reports about 30 youth attending an overnight statewide church retreat at First Congregational Church in Jamestown were taken ill from carbon monoxide fumes Friday morning, October 23rd. Hospital spokesman Bill Kennedy says the 30 middle school age youth and two supervisors were taken to Jamestown Hospital's emergency room for treatment. The call by the pastor to the LEC Dispatch Center came at about 8:25 a.m. Call to the scene to transport the youth for Jamestown Area Ambulance Service with two units taking a total of eight youth to the Jamestown Hospital Emergency Room, and Jamestown City Fire Units took the remainder. Jamestown Police assisted at the scene, and some were able to walk out on their own while others needed assistance. Jamestown City Fire Chief Jim Ruther says when firefighters arrived at the church, just inside the main floor door, a carbon monoxide reading of 379 parts per million was recorded, a very high reading. He says that number is life-threatening if individuals are exposed for up to 3 hours.
We were called out to check for carbon monoxide at the address of 201 Second Street Southeast. Firefighters went in and checked. They got into a certain, not very far, 10 to 20 feet possibly, and had a reading for 379 parts per million. And at that time, it was determined that they needed to evacuate the building. Jamestown Area Ambulance, Jamestown Police Department, Jamestown Fire Department, firefighters are on scene, evacuated the building, brought all the occupants out of the building, and then Jamestown Area Ambulance was transporting Jamestown Fire Department, transported in one of the fire trucks and one of their other support vehicles. All up to the hospital.
And how many victims, if you will, were in the church and needed assistance and hospitalization?
All as I know, there was approximately 30 individuals that were there.
Mm-hmm. And how would you term the situation relative to the severity of it when you folks arrived on the scene?
All right, I'm going to pass through him. Gave you the general idea of something that happened. There was a camp. Kids were sleeping over, and you know, a fire occurred, carbon monoxide incident occurred, and the stories are normally very similar. But point illustration, it's a church, and it's occurred, and it's things that we need to consider. These things will actually happen. Back to your question about carbon monoxide is slightly lighter than air. Air's molecular weight is 28.8, and carbon monoxide is 28.0, so there's just a 0.8 difference on that. So it's gonna, for the most part, be stagnant in the general area of where your body is. It's not gonna sit just on the ground, and it's not gonna sit way up high. And that's, does that kind of answer your question? Fire behavior, it's gonna, as you can see in the picture, it's gonna have this chimney effect. The smoke and the flames are going to go to the path of least resistance, smoke specifically. It's going to fill the area from top to bottom. Quick video here. This was done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, actually in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Watch the clock down on the bottom. You can see a fire started. This room is actually built in a lab, but nothing has been treated or done differently other than the Christmas tree being put there. The walls and the furniture, everything is as it would be in your home, and it's just showing you. I mean, we're at 20 seconds. Smoke's already a third of the way down. The tree's fully engulfed. You can see the walls, and actually down here on the furniture are starting to smother. The flames aren't even hitting it. It's the heat. The room is just, at this point in time, everything is starting to burn. 39, 40 seconds, halfway down. You can see just the smoke is just closing in. 50 seconds, complete dark out. Everything in that room is on fire, whether it be, it's pretty much a flashover state. So if there's something in that room and it can physically burn, you know, at less than a minute, it's burning. So think about that. By the time I could walk outside and call 911, everything's already lit up. So that is what was occurring inside the other video that we actually watched at the station fire. I mean, it's still going, a minute 15, but there's nothing there. You know, there's nothing to see. That's how quick a fire can start and a whole room can go up. That's why fire protection, like sprinklers, like having not one or two fire extinguishers, but having multiple fire extinguishers, you know, in every location that you can grab them and use them are so important, because in the first 30 seconds, if I got a fire extinguisher, I may have been able to put that fire out. A minute later, there was no shot. Have you guys ever heard the term backdraft? I don't know if you remember the movie that occurred. I get a lot of people that ask me questions, well, what is a backdraft and what happens with a backdraft? So it's not common. It doesn't occur all the time. But a backdraft, as it states on the slide, it's when the fire starved of oxygen, but the gases and everything is heating up and it's at this high temperature. All of a sudden, something happens, like in the movie, a door opens. That environment is getting rapidly introduced to oxygen, and boom, everything explodes. So quick, this is just a 10-second video. You can see some firefighters fighting this fire. They're up close. They're in it with the hose. They're trying to knock it down. Nobody's inside. Everybody's external. But the interior is just heating up. In a second, a window will break. Oxygen will get introduced. We're patiently waiting. Boom. The backdraft occurs and the explosion happens. And you can see.
So were those firefighters not following procedure and being so close?
Nope. They were.
Or does that just happen?
Unfortunately, it's why they say firefighting is dangerous. It does occur. There are different techniques that different jurisdictions do to protect against it. I don't have all the details on what was burning in that building and all the details behind this other than the backdraft occurring. So I can't specifically answer the question and relate it to that exact scenario. But it's just one of those things that happens, unfortunately. Ladder 49 is a movie from a firefighter's perspective that I would definitely recommend. Again, I'll state from a firefighting perspective and just kind of some realistic views of, you know, a 5-alarm fire, an abandoned warehouse, an industrial scenario. But you can see just kind of some of the things that they go through and things along those lines. There's five main classes of fires. Four of them are more common. But a Class A fire would be your ordinary combustibles, things like paper and wood, plastics. Class B would be flammable liquids and gases. C would be an electrical fire. D, combustible metals. An example of a combustible metal would be magnesium, commonly found in your car, part of your engine blocks, and then cooking oils. The most common fire extinguisher is what we call an ABC fire extinguisher. Sometimes they throw D in it. So if you have a fire extinguisher, you want to know, okay, what type of fire extinguisher is this? If it's a water fire extinguisher, commonly they're in the silver cans, normally a little bit larger, you're not going to want to use a water extinguisher on a Class C fire. Why? Well, you don't put water on electricity. It's just not going to work. You don't want to put water on cooking oils. Why? It's just going to spread it. So an ABC extinguisher is good for ordinary combustibles, flammable liquids, and electric. It's normally a powdered base. You don't have to think about it. It's why they're in the majority of the places. So when you go back to your church, look at your fire extinguishers. Check, are they in date? Have they been inspected? Look at the little gauge. Is it charged? Is it overcharged? Is it undercharged? Those are all things you want to look at. What kind of extinguisher is it? Is it an ABC extinguisher? Is it just a water extinguisher? If you're having a campfire, maybe I want water there, but maybe I don't need chemicals there. So kind of keep that in mind, and it's something to look at when you go back. Alluded to this, but there's different things that can be inside the fire extinguisher. You can have dry chemicals. Halon. Halon is a chemical that is still used. What it does is it takes the oxygen out of the air. So we learned in one of our first slides that a fire needs really four things, and oxygen was one of them. So if halon will remove one of those four, then you can't have a fire, and the fire is going to go out. Halon, fortunately, is very toxic, and it's very toxic to the environment. So the government passed a law saying that halon is no longer allowed to be manufactured. However, it can still be recycled and be used. So you will see it. A lot of times it's common in areas that have high-tech equipment, computer labs, music studios, things along those lines. They've since engineered replacements that do very similar things that aren't as toxic to the environment. Water, that's an example of a common-looking water extinguisher. Carbon dioxide, not myoxide, but dioxide. What that does is it's actually going to freeze the fire, and it's going to be a rapid cooling effect, which, again, we learned that a fire has four things. Heat, oxygen, were two of them. We already talked about oxygen with the halon. Well, that carbon dioxide is going to affect the heat and rapidly cool it and prevent the fire from continuing. Normally, if you see the fire extinguishers with the big bells, those are common CO2 or carbon dioxide. Fire alarm systems. Does your church have a fire alarm system? No. Okay. They're important. Do you smoke detectors? I guarantee you, I'd probably say you don't have a sprinkler system. I'm surprised that you don't have a fire alarm system. I would have thought that, I don't know specific, law here in Kentucky, but I would have thought that there would have been some law that passed where you would have had to put something in, but maybe not. 100 years old, grandfathered, and
pretty much everything, which is nice in some sense, and it's unfortunate in other sense.
Sure.
Well,
there's a vendor here who specializes in fire alarms and security alarms. I definitely would try to. Sorry, I'm going over here, guys, but I would try to talk to them and see, if anything, at the most basic level, what could I get? What could we do? Because a fire alarm, I mean, that's going to be your evacuation point. You're going to have people all throughout that church. And you saw how quickly that fire started. You need something that, one, is going to automatically pick it up, and two, that's going to alert everybody in the facility of a need for evacuation. Different types of components that go with it. You have smoke, heat, flame, duct, beam, manual pull stations. You can have fire alarms that have horns, bells, buzzers, strobes, recorded messages. Get in here. We obviously have an exit sign, which is good, but... I don't see. Yep, that's an emergency light, which is good, but I don't see any strobes or alarms in here. I know they have them in the hallways. You have different types of fire alarms again. You guys not having one makes this a little easier. I don't need to really explain a lot that's going on with it because, you don't have one. But you can have zoned and unzoned. You can have alarms that will, for example, just go off in this building but not alert in the other building. You have control panels and annunciator panels and just all different parts of the fire alarm. I'm going to kind of breeze through some of these slides. This is basically saying that there's two types of smoke detectors, an ionization detector and a photoelectric detector. They're just different ways that smoke alarms work, different technology behind them. It's not that important that you have to get into the specifics. The bottom line is get a smoke detector, make sure you have them. Heat detectors, they work as heat rises. The detector goes off. Flame detectors actually look for that ultraviolet or infrared and try to see the flame, and that will set the alarm off. For notification systems, you have delayed activation. A lot of hotels have it, or schools like this with an actual security team where they say if the alarm goes off, they may get the signal in their control center and they can send an officer to investigate and see is it an actual alarm prior to having to interrupt and evacuate all the schools and classes. Other places, if the smoke detector or heat detector goes off, it's instantly activated and the alarms and bells go off. Where does it alarm to? Does it go to a control center? Does it immediately go to the fire department? Does it go to ADT that's monitoring it? Does it go nowhere and it just makes an audible alarm, you know, in your church? So fire systems, you know, there are fire protection engineers and people that are specialized and go to school in designing and building these things, because you can make them really any way you want them. No fire alarm system is the same, so it's good to keep that in mind. Fire sprinkler systems, again, you guys don't have them, but it's good to know there's different types. You have what are called wet systems and dry systems. Wet systems, there's actually water right behind the sprinkler head. Dry systems have air, and there's a delayed reaction for the water to actually get there. Quick video here.
Fire sprinkler systems were invented over 120 years ago. Since then, several hundred million sprinkler heads have been installed throughout the world. A typical sprinkler head comprises a threaded body to connect to pipework, with a valve seal to hold back the water. The valve seal is retained by a glass bulb, which contains a liquid that has a high coefficient of expansion. A small, measured quantity of vapor remains trapped when the bulb is hermetically sealed. When the liquid expands under the influence of heat from a fire, pressure in the bulb rises until the vapor is compressed. Further increases in temperature cause a rapid buildup of pressure sufficient to shatter the bulb, releasing the valve seal and allowing the water to flow onto a water distribution.
You guys ever see the movie Kindergarten Cop? I don't know if you remember the scene in that movie, but Arnold is going through the school when the fire alarm or the sprinkler system has been activated, and the whole entire school is getting flooded because every single sprinkler is going off. Well, as that video explained, what occurs is this area right in here heats up. This happens to be a fusible link. The video talked about gases that can be in there. As that fusible link either burns or melts due to heat, or as those gases heat up due to heat, that breaks, water comes from the pipe behind this, hits this distributor, and goes out. So it's going to activate one single sprinkler head at a time. The whole entire building's not going to go off. The whole entire church and sanctuary is not going to flood. The whole entire building is not going to be destroyed. I will put a note that there are some select systems that will activate all at once. They're very rare. I've never seen one in my life. I know they exist. I've just never seen one. So a little bit of knowledge when you go back and you have somebody that says, well, I don't want to put a sprinkler in, or we shouldn't have a sprinkler because the whole place is going to flood when somebody accidentally bumps it or something. Exactly. Well, you'd be surprised. These are called standpipes. There are a lot of places that have fire systems. They're for the fire department to hook up to, more or less used in a lot of high-rise buildings. Fire hydrants. Do you guys have fire hydrants close to your... It's worth looking at. It's worth...
The fact that we don't know all this stuff, things we have to figure out. Like,
well, and these are good things to think about. You know, do you have fire hydrants? Where are they located? Are people parking in front of them? Do we put the trash out in front of them? Do you know where to tell the fire department, hey, it's over there, in case they don't? Are they in service or are they out of service like these? You may not get a lot of snow here. I have been in Louisville when it snowed before, so you do get some. When the snow comes, or if there's a weather issue or construction, you know, is that fire hydrant covered? Can I go out and dig it out so the fire department's not searching for it? Do you have a sprinkler room? You guys don't. If you ever do, can I open that door in an emergency and get to the sprinkler room and the things that are inside? You know, just a little bit of preemptive shoveling and making sure that if there's an emergency, you know, you can get there. That happens to be in my neighborhood. Just a little bit. That pile ended up being about 10 feet tall by the time we were done shoveling out. But it's an important factor in things to think about.
A sprinkler room for your house?
Yes. Yeah. I live in a condo. So, other things to think about. This is called a HUMAP valve. Different jurisdictions use different things with their fire department. The way many jurisdictions do it, they have this thing called the HUMAP valve. It's actually hooked up to the hose, which is on the back of the engine. Well, that valve needs to hook up to the hydrant. Do you think this valve can hook up to that hydrant like that? No, why not? Yeah, it's too low to the ground. There's been so much landscaping done there that they've built up on it. So there's no way, and I know for a fact, I won't say right here, but I know for a fact that this jurisdiction uses the HUMAP valve. That hydrant is useless. They can't use it. They got to dig it. Yeah. So it's going to take, like you said, 10 minutes to dig it out. We've already learned how fast fires occur, and you have a useless hydrant. If you don't have water, you can't put it out. So just things to think about, things that churches can address. Evacuation, where's your nearest primary exit? Are the stairwells, are they pressurized? Your church is not pressurized. Newer buildings have them, so there's a positive air pressure in the stairwell. So you can get into the stairwell. There's positive air being blown into it, which means that smoke and toxic fumes can't get into it. So that stairwell is a safe haven and will protect you as you exit out of the building. There's really nothing you're going to be able to do that about it at your church, but it's good knowledge to know. A secondary means of egress, is there a window that I can get out if I had to, another way to escape, things along those lines. Things to consider, how are we going to be notified? You guys don't have an alarm system. Can you go and spend $10 and get a bullhorn? Have multiple bullhorns positioned in strategic places behind the stage, at a welcome center, in the lobby, and have certain people whose job in the event of emergency or in the event of evacuation can get on that bullhorn and be letting the church know, this is a fire, we need to evacuate, the nearest exit is here. Things to consider, those are options for you. Again, you don't have a fire alarm, so a lot of fire alarms have voice announcements. What do they say? Does your church congregation, do they know what to do in the event of a fire? If you have a fire alarm, do they know what it sounds like? Is it a voice recording? Is it bilingual? Do you have a large Spanish population, you know, like we have in the Washington, D.C.? Are they going to understand this lady in a calm voice coming over the loudspeaker telling you to evacuate? Or do you need to have a bilingual translation on there? Where are we going to go and what's going to happen with the children? If you have a children's ministry and you have a whole lot of parents that are in the main sanctuary and they're being told that they need to evacuate and they see flames and they see smoke, there's one thought in their mind, their kids. That can really hurt the situation if they are trying to go to their children rather than leaving the building and going to safety. Well, that begs the question, what's happening with the children? As church pastors, as administrators, you have to have a plan. You have to have a way that you're going to get those children out of that building in the event of emergency. And whether that's having strategic ushers, staff members, volunteers, it's going to be specific to your facility. But you got to come up with a plan that if on Sunday a fire breaks out, how are you going to get those children out while the parents are evacuating from a different portion of the building? Good.
We got that stuff out there.
Perfect.
We don't, like, there's no way of telling the parents will all rush there. When they do, it's into the middle of the building and not to the exits, and their children would be going out the other door, and there's no way that they would know that.
Currently, but if you guys have address it to them or you come up with a plan and let them know, have a church meeting, send a letter out, hey, we want to let you know this is what our fire plan is, or this is our plan in the event of a tornado, things along those lines. Again, what are you going to do if there's a fire? Whose job is it to call 911? You guys don't have a fire alarm that's going to do it automatically. Is it the administrators? Is it the pastors? Is it the janitors? Do I have two people whose responsibility it is? Is it the general congregation? So just think about, how's that plan going to work? Who's going to be the authority to call 911? Do you want all your members dialing 911 for anything, or do you want to have strategic people that are going to notify the fire department and have them come? I'm going to skip this video. It's about a 10-second video of a church and the roof collapses. Common fire hazards, poor housekeeping, improper storage of combustible materials, or illegal storage of things. Defective and improper use of heating, lighting, or power equipment. Electrical fires are key. 100-year-old church? How about old and faulty electrical wiring? I guarantee you that that wiring's not up to code. It's old, and it's going to create problems. Lack of relevant fire protection systems at your church as well. Do you have more people in that building than maybe the fire marshal would want you to? Could be a concern. Do you have inadequate exit lighting? Probably, the church being as old as it is. So, I mean, you guys, one, two, three, four things. I don't know about the top one. You know, you guys definitely would be in a high threat situation as far as your church is concerned. That's why I'm sure you came.
That's why we chose this.
Exactly. Hopefully you're learning something. Average of 1,300 church fires reported each year, costing about $38 million in property loss. Costs a lot of money for fire protection. Costs a lot more money when your church burns down. Things to consider. The single most leading cause of church fires is arson. 25% of them are associated with it. For some reason, there's an attraction with arson related to churches. There's definitely multiple federal task forces that have been established to try to cut that down. The next leading cause is electrical. You guys fall into that. Heating is third at 12%. You guys fall into that. Open flames and candles. That's huge. That's huge, especially in a building like yours that's so old. I would have a rule: no open flames. You know, we're sitting in a matchbox with the timber as old as it is and the things. There's no way I would let an open flame into a church like yours. Candlelight services are pretty, especially around Christmas time. Weddings. Not in a church that says
the only rule we have now is no, you have to have dripless candles. We should say no candles.
I would turn it into electronic candles. Ones with little batteries in it.
So the electrical system can burn the building down.
Battery powered.
It seems like we should go to all open flames rather than turning the lights on. Just
it might be safer. You're right. It might be. You guys are in this last statistic, but of the churches that reported fires, 65% of them had no smoke alarms, 96% of them had no sprinkler system. You guys fall right into that statistic right there. It's related to what you said. A lot of churches are old. A lot of them have been grandfathered into local jurisdiction law. Unfortunately, it's deadly, and it's killing people, and it's a serious issue. Churches, for the most part, don't have a lot of money, and they can't always address the situation. That's something to consider. Suggestions: fire drill at least twice a year. Make sure that your church members know what to do. Proper maintenance on fire extinguishers and or the system if you have it. Have a plan for children's ministry like we talked about. Have a meeting place that's away from sensitive fire department locations. What I mean by that is if you have a fire hydrant right in front of your church, don't make that the spot that you're going to have everybody in your church evacuate to. Think, hey, the fire department's probably going to want to put the fire truck here, so let's not have, you know, the whole church congregation standing right where the fire department's going to need to be. And invite, as we talked about, your local fire department to come in and do a walkthrough. Bullhorn backstage is a good suggestion. Sorry, definitely went over there a little bit. Appreciate the patience in the beginning with the technical problems. Any questions you guys have other than yours, and I'll flip this off and get to that.